Welcome to the Collections by Michelle Brown Show, a show about people living between the lines, standing boldly in the crosshairs of their intersectionality as they create change. This episode is brought to you in partnership with the Center for Peace Counseling and Holistic Healing Services. Welcome to Collections by Michelle Brown. I'm your host, Michelle Brown. This is the podcast connecting with people living between the lines, standing boldly in the crosshairs of their intersectionality and creating change across the country and the world. Kyler Brodus is more than a dear friend. He's a true warrior for equality, civil rights, the LGBTQ community in general, but especially transgender individuals from communities of color. This attorney, longtime activist, public speaker, author, and professor is a groundbreaking trailblazer who forged the way for many of today's leaders. Not content to sit on his laurels, Kyler continues his advocacy in New York, Washington, D.C., and across the nation. It's with great pleasure that I welcome my brother, Kyler Brodus, back to Collections by Michelle Brown.
Well, we're here on Collections by Michelle Brown, and what a wonderful way to start this new year than talking with my brother from another mother, but of this Mother Earth, Kyler. I love you. You know, we were just sort of reminiscing, and I can think of so many times us sitting in and creating change, but then sitting in a bar afterwards and just sort of laughing and talking, and you know, with different friends that we've had, some who are no longer with us, like Monica Roberts. And, you know, it has always been such a joy to be in your presence. Happy New Year, my brother.
Well, Happy New Year, my sister. And I can say the same. I've had so much pleasure and joy with you sharing space, whether it be food, or just sitting and talking, as you said, in any space, and just talking and enjoying the company and taking it in. And I so value that, and certainly have missed that through this time of COVID, and look forward to reconnecting with you soon in person. So you be safe out there and take care of yourself.
So, I'm doing the best I can. You know, I was talking with Kathy Renner about creating change, and they talked about, you know, I know that this year they're going to, you know, because it's the anniversary year, but when she was saying, well, you know, we're not going to do creating change like we used to. It's going to be, you know, like virtual and in different cities and 365. But those were the times when, you know, I knew I was going to run it. You know, if I didn't see you at other things, it was that time when I was going to see you, see my friends from all across the country, and we just sort of sit around and kick it, you know, not only about what was going on with the movement, but with what was going on with each other. And I told her, I said, you know, in some ways, it's a big loss to me to not have it. You know, and to not have that historical memory, especially for young queer youth who are coming up, who have never experienced that. What do you think about us no longer having, you know, that regular gathering? And how important do you think it was to building this movement that we have that some would say is in crisis right now.
Well, Michelle, I have to agree with your statement. It was very vital that that was a place at least once a year that people came together, that you got to know people that you might have heard about, that you may never have met, that you got to also experience new and cutting edge work that was going on in the movement. And I remember presenting plenty of new ideas that happened at Creating Change in different workshops, and then also learning from other people that were there. So I think that's a big loss to the community. And I do think that while we're in crisis, I think that's even a bigger loss, because we need a place where we can come together like that. And, you know, I mean, I made so many friends there. I remember somebody said, all those people used to follow you around. And, you know, I'm not saying that for my ego, but it just is what happened. It was a symbiotic, I don't know what symbiotic or sort of thing that happened. Just honest, it was I don't know if symbiotic is the right word, but it was just an automatic thing because people had heard of me, and then they would just follow me around, and the crowd would get large around me, and people said they didn't know what that was about. And I think that that was LG people not knowing about what was going on in the trans movement, because we didn't have spaces as big that we could gather. And so people would. I would have this massive crowd of people following me around, like the Pied Piper, because we could then spend time together and get to know each other and bond and talk about things and what was going on in their part of the country and just have this fellowship. And then even LG people then joined in that crowd that did have the know of what was going on, the lay of the land of trans people and the want to know. And so I think it's a big loss. I'm not sure, have they checked in with people, whether this was an institutional decision on its own, but I think it's a huge loss. And I think it's a huge loss for our community, because we lose places like that, that I've advocated for years, that we come together and sit together and sort of sup together, if you will, and share food, share friendship, share family, make family, and for people to get to know. Because wherever I go and speak, I always urge young activists to come to Creating Change. And then I think historically it takes away from people of understanding how the movement was built. And that's going to be my last point on this, because there you learned how the movement was built. And while, you know, I was a college professor, I learned that young people lost the value of history and don't have that. And Creating Change was a place that you could get that. And I think that's important as well, because I always had the saying, and I'm sure there's somebody out there that has a big quote about it, but my saying to my students were, if you don't know where you came from, how do you know where you're going? Because that's so important in the frame of reference and learning. And I learned that myself just on my own, and would impart that to my students. And they got it, because it makes it easier to have a framework of then knowing where you're going. So I think it's a huge loss, and we'll see what happens in the movement going forward. And I'll share my critique on, you know, I think the movement had problems anyway, and I worked in many different capacities within the movement, from race building to trans building to doing lots of things at that conference that I do think made a difference. And so it's just, I think, a sad thing for individuals and the movement.
Well, you know, and it is true because, you know, you get to rub shoulders with people, and as you get to rub shoulders with them, you get to know them. Like people would see, and it wasn't mm-hmm. like just your name on a placard or on a program. You go in the bar, there you'd be sitting, and you know, and then you get the real thing. And the thing was, like, we didn't always all get along. I remember that year in Chicago, and you know, but then, you know, you saw people who fell out, but then later on were able to think about it and come together. I mean, but now I see some of these young people, and you'll mention names, and they'll go like, oh, I didn't know, or they talk about something like it's all brand new, and you want to say, well, hey, you know, this happened so that this happened so that this happened. It wasn't just like one day Pose was on TV and we were here. You know what I mean? It's like,
yes.
You
sorry, know? Go ahead. Yes. No, say it. Yes.
Because it is. I mean, there were people. Like, I would often tell people, because they're like, how do you know Andre Jenkins? I said, hey, sitting in the bar, she came down, had a copy of her book, you know, and we started talking. And, you know, same with, I knew Monica, like, too, like, so where you were able to sit and talk and you wanted to know, well, what's the real deal? I knew I could pick up and call them. I could call you, find out what's the real deal. Where now sometimes, you know, you sort of look and you go, well, what is the real deal? And who knows? And who knows the pathway that got here? I can recall when Trayvon Martin got killed and people mm-hmm. going like, I can recall talking to black people who were like, oh, and this is just so horrible that this happened. I said, well, you must never have heard of Emmett Till. And there were some who didn't know that. So if you don't know what's been happening, your response to it might not be correct.
Exactly. And that that was the beauty of it. And creating change always was about some kind of movement change. And it was at times never pretty. It wasn't just Chicago. It was every creating change
mm-hmm.
that there was something to work through. And that's what families or movements do. You know, mm-hmm. I can recall being woken up on Miami Beach and to go to the police station to help, you know, resolve an issue. I mean, that was just part of the growing pains and the issues of being with activists in different cities. There was usually an act that happened in the cities. Although we, you know, wanted to be careful about not just coming to a city and taking it by storm and then leaving it with the people that were there. But things came up that people reacted to that had to be dealt with. And I think that's where strong leadership comes in, whether it be the group that's putting it on or they coalesce with many groups to deal with what the issues that might arise there. But I do agree with you that, yeah, you know, like you said, understanding where Trayvon Martin comes from, you need to understand and know about Emmett Till. And that's uh-huh. one of the critiques I have about the LGBT movement. It is very white-led, and, you uh-huh. know, I get no kudos for saying that, and it loses me a lot of money in the movement for saying that. But truth is truth. And, you know, I was trying to think of the book that, you know, everybody's trying to do anti-racist work, but it's led by white people. You
uh-huh.
know, and it's just like, that's problematic. And then you can't have that done. And I remember in the earlier days, if we led the anti-racist work, we meaning I'm a person of color, for those people that don't know that, I would hope you know that by now. And, uh-huh. and those were the things. And it's like, and then all of a sudden we flipped the script and we have all of these non-people of color leading anti-racist work. Where does that thought come from, and why is that okay, or why do people think that's okay? And we particularly need to have those discussions now. You know, I remember when George Floyd was killed, and then we had a black trans man that was killed 2 days later by the police in Florida, and we could hardly get, we had our young trans men and black people thinking, oh, well, Black Lives Matter would pick that up, and that's a misnomer and a problem. And then the greater movement didn't pick it up, and his name was Tony McDade, and he was killed after the police got up, got there, and within 5 seconds, and they were called to help come to do an intervention for him mentally, but they didn't, and they just shot him and killed him in cold blood. And so people don't know about that, so finally it did make it, because my little group, with its 2 tin cans and strings, and I was very ill, and then so was my deputy at the time, Brendan Watts, made enough noise to where we got people's attention, and we didn't sleep, and I was not supposed to be doing that, because my doctors had told me no stress, but I was damned that Tony McDade's name was going to make it in the press, and it did. And it's not always about taking credit for something. It's about getting the job done. And those are lessons and part of what I wanted to impart today as well. It's like, I've done lots of things, and it's not about taking credit for the press. It's about getting the job done. And his name did get out there, and then some Black Lives chapters picked it up, and some of the mainstream media picked it up. But then his name disappeared again real quickly. And that's not okay that we marginalize any people within the movement. His life, sadly George Floyd did die, but we then mentioned all the other names of people that die, and we never pick up trans masculine people, who I've always said, when I first said, I remember people look at me crazy when I said that all marginalized people, particularly trans women of color, were vulnerable on the streets. And it was one of the first ones, which you can find in the Georgetown journals, that was an issue. And people looked at me like I was nuts. And then the count started to come, and I said it was going to be visible. Well, what happens is we're still invisible. And now we're starting to see that it's all vulnerable people on the street, because we're starting to see the trans, masculine, non-binary, however people identify, that are just not mainstream people, come out. Or the numbers show, because one, people don't know how to count the numbers. Some of them are not getting reported, but all of these deaths and killings, and not only that, but the black community itself is a target, and we don't want to acknowledge that. Again, yesterday, the police just killed a black man who was trying to wave them down for help, and they just shot him. And he was needing assistance, not the criminal that had done whatever act that somebody called in and said he did. And we need to deal with those issues when we say we're an inclusive movement. But that's the stuff we need to take the mirror and look at. And it's not blaming anybody, but it's calling those things out and not then getting punished for calling those things out, but being saying, hey, that makes sense, so why not let us do that work? And it's like, instead of pushing people like that off your boards, out of your organizations, and the like, because that makes us a stronger, better movement, especially if we expect to partner with people that are like-minded.
Because, you know, Kyla, you've been doing this for a long time. You have been very vocal. You have been in front of Congress. You have been doing it now. And saying these same things. And we knew you were saying it. They listened and nodded. But now, suddenly you have, and let's call it like it is, white trans people are like, oh, look, here's another trans person who got elected to this and these high positions who like you said, don't really have that perspective, don't understand how for a black trans man, okay, there's a bullseye on the back of a black man, but if you're a black trans man and you're out driving, your risk of ending up dead skyrockets on so many ways. You can be pulled over for driving as black, being a black man, and then let's hope all your paperwork is in order, or that someone doesn't figure out that you're a trans man. I mean, there's so many, you don't hear that. You don't hear that where's the uproar about that? And like you said, where are the statistics? The closest that you hear to statistics are usually, and I hate to say it, but when you go to a Transgender Day of Remembrance thing, which is often run by a white trans group, but most of the names that they call are black and brown people. Trans men and women.
Yes.
So it's like, it's okay to use us when we're victims, you know, to talk about, oh, and look, we're still getting killed, and, you know, trans people are getting killed and shot. We have to have this. But where are we? Why aren't we in that bigger conversation? Why aren't they lifting us up, gathering those statistics and really doing something to real work at protecting trans women of color, particularly who are black and brown, who are getting killed, misgendered, and just sort of swept under the table, under the carpet, in the police reports and in the news media?
Exactly. And, you know, while there's some that's being done, again, it's always led by the wrong people, not the right mixture of people. And it's just, you know, we got to look at ourselves, you know. And like you said, I've been doing this for decades now. And we got to look around the table and say, you know, if there's not a good mixture of people and they all look one way, then there's something wrong. And then if we only applaud good things that are happening when so many bad things are happening, then we got to say something is wrong, which is what you just said. It's like, yeah, when we're only at Trans Day of Remembrance saying, oh, these are the people that died, and I'm glad people have caught the phrase, these are the people we know that have died, because I always correct people and say that, because there's lots more that haven't been identified. And so we started with the FBI, which was good, and it depends on, of course, which administration is in office. But, you know, we can do a lot of this work. Where's all this funding going? We can do a lot of this work without them by working with local authorities in the major cities, and helping educate police on what to look for and make this a national program ourselves. It's like, why isn't any of the major organizations housing the program like that? You know, we house all the other programs, and, you know, yes, people should be running for office. That's how we make change. But we can be making instant change by doing this program, by going after and identifying and helping police identify people. And, you know, the closest I got was in one organization and the press guy, and we were doing this, and we got so much blowback from white non-trans people that it was just amazing, because we were bringing this to the top and to the news media's attention, which is where it has to go, and starting to cover groundwork. And people didn't understand, and it's like that they were just helping to kill more of us by being jealous about us getting this work accomplished, you know, because that's always been my mission, is to save other lives. And I mean, that's just been it. It's like, you know, I felt like I have been blessed. Have I been scared, and has my life been threatened? Yes, it has. But I have been blessed by the ability to withstand so far, and realizing some of my health detriment has been to sacrificing and doing this work in this way when I could have just gone off and tried to get a job. But that even impacts Black and brown people. You can put up a chart and, you know, people say, oh, well, you just go off and get a job. No, I can't. You know, now I've got, I can add AIDS discrimination to that. But before that, I had Black and brown discrimination. Because you can look at that and you can see that. And then some of our young Black people cringe at that because they can get a job. But there's a lot of our young, very young Black and brown people that can't get jobs. And so that's where, again, the real story needs to surface and be told. You know, because I remember walking the halls of Congress when I was lobbying, and they would say, oh, well, you guys are covered because they just assume we're all gay. And it's like, well, no, I'm not gay. I'm transgender. And when I put my resume out and it has all this trans work, definitely nobody wants me, and very few, if anybody. And so even though my skills are transferable, because, you know, I was a business professor, so I could explain that, and I know how to do all that. I could tell my students how to do that with whatever work they've done. But nobody sees that when you put your transness out there in that way, and they don't want you. And then secondly, there's nobody helping to do that, even within our movement, because you can see the young white trans men get jobs and women and get jobs and get promoted. But if you're a Black person, that doesn't necessarily happen unless you're of a certain demeanor. And that demeanor is filling or fitting the description of a white person. I'm just going to be honest about it. It's like, you know, people assume I'm a certain way. And I worked in corporate America, and I was at management level, and somehow they don't see that and then want to call certain things unprofessional. Well, that's when a person, and this comes from my not only schooling, but being a professor, has determined, has become frustrated with your process. So now what you're getting is they're angry and upset with your process. So that's what you're going to get. Not the person that is competent and that can do it, but they've had enough of being treated poorly by you.
You know, I know a woman who she's a trans sister. She got a job with an organization, and their whole thing was like, well, hey, you know, trans is hot. You know, that's woohoo, there's money out there. So they hired this Black trans woman. But later she and I were talking because she didn't say, because, like you were saying, well, they wanted her to be Black, but not too Black, you know, not too Black. And often wanted to send her to places where it was like white trans people, and she wanted to advocate for her own community. And it was like, you know, well, you're spending too much time here, and you should go over there and do that. So it was like, okay, they wanted to say, hey, we've got one, and oh, look, hey, and she's Black. But then, you know, there were all these microaggressions, all these things that sort of said, we want you, but not like you. We'd rather have someone who is more, and as they say, passable, who hasn't lived a life. I know another woman who did the job as interim director, did the job, had more degrees than the prior director had, but when it came down to the final hire, it was like, well, and they went with a white gay man.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, so there's this bigger movement where they cherry pick who they want. And if you're not, like you said, fitting that perfect little thing, oh, well, you know, and they think you might be trying to help too many Black people, too many brown people, you're not going anywhere.
Yeah.
And we don't, you know, our movement, and then they'll come up and they'll say something, you know, like, okay, well, maybe they'll have a dinner and have a Laverne Cox speak. And I love Laverne Cox. But they think, well, look, we've done it. Look who we had as our speaker. But if you dig down and you look at their board of directors, their staffing, their programming, They're getting that money, but they're not sharing the wealth.
Exactly, exactly. And I totally agree with you. I hope I'm not stepping on anything else you had to say, but just wanting to chime in that, you know, that happens because I have so much experience, and I honestly hate that I jumped in working at these LGBT nonprofits because I got much more respect working in the regular world than I did in an LGBT nonprofit. People respected me. They respected my talent and gave me my due. What I thought, you know, I was going to enter, I didn't think anybody expect anybody to kiss my feet, you know, but I thought I would be respected for the professional I was. And that was always giving me a job that was not at my level, if that makes sense. It was way beneath my level. And then they would act as if I couldn't do that job, but I would just be astounded. And then they would want to micromanage me. And I already had jobs where, you know, I could write out a draft at the financial company I was at larger than most of their budgets were. Do you hear me? Do you know what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And so for them then to treat me that way, it was just wild. And I mean, without much management, because they had training and whatever. So I was already there and at management level. And so literally at the, you know, and this was in my 20s. So I could literally write out a draft larger than most of the budgets of these nonprofits were without, and I had authority because of my experience. So I didn't need to go to anybody for that and just do it because I followed the rules and guidelines. But then to get into these organizations and to be given a low-level job and then and for them to be unclear, because it was just like, it was saying to me, and I've heard people say this before, who does he think he is? Which is code for us, as we know as Black and brown people, for, you know, stay in your lane. You're
Thank
doing
you.
Too much as a black person.
He don't know his place.
Exactly. Thank you for helping me with that. Uh-huh. Because, yeah, and it astounded me that I was hearing this in LGBTQ nonprofits. And that I would hear that all the time. And, you know, I only have one boss that I ever respected out of LGBT nonprofits, and I'm going to give her kudos with Elizabeth Birch. Elizabeth Birch respected me. She always hired people with talent. And, you know, and I'm a student, a scholar of management, and that tells you you've got an excellent leader, okay? And she entrusted me, believed in me. I worked many a late night or project with her doing something because I didn't care what the hours were. If I was needed, I would do them or whatever. Never questioned my integrity, my ability, or my what have you. And it's always been my ride or die when I would end up in one of these situations at another LGBTQ organization who wanted to accuse me of numerous things, and they didn't even know me, didn't know my story, and would say, well, why would those people want to follow you around? Like, and I would never say, well, don't you know who I am? You know, because it's like, well, before Laverne and Janet were here, you know, they just didn't get it. But even the lower level people at the organization got who I was, you know, because tons of people would want to take pictures with me at Creating Change or wherever I'm at. You know, I'm stopped. People want to take pictures with me. I'm recognized in other countries. So I'm not saying I'm all of that, but that you as management don't know who I am and what I have done in the movement, and then would say that, like, well, who does he think he is? And, like, why would anybody want to do that with him? And I even had one person that was black and say, oh, well, you think you're something because you took a picture with President Obama, but didn't know how many presidents I'd met working at the Human Rights Campaign. It's like, mm-hmm. so that's never been a big deal to me. They didn't know how many dignitaries I met even before I worked in the LGBT movement, you know? And it's like, I'm not that kind of person. So you're talking to the wrong kind of person. It's like, I treat people with respect for their position, but I've met tons of dignitaries, tons of movie stars. None of that stuff goes to my head. I don't ask for autographs. Because what would you do with it, you know? And this is my thinking. And I treat people as people. So, but that's the stuff I put up with in the movement. And it just astounded me once I went to work in the movement. But yet everybody wants me on their board. And didn't realize I've been the first of a lot of things in the movement, particularly the trans movement. And but I don't list as I'm the first this, I'm the first that, I'm the first. It's like, because it's pointless to do that. But it's that you don't know, which goes back to our original point of this conversation, starting with creating change of people not knowing, and even at that organization or any organization, that it's important for people to understand the lineage and history of this movement, including, you know, AIDS, all of those impactful things and how it's pushed the movement forward. And we don't know that unless we have a sit down and a talk and a togetherness of the movement, so people get a grasp or understanding of how we've come here.
You know, it's funny because last year, before the election, Kelly Robinson was in town. She was brought in by, so they had this little small reception. And I want to say you could count the black people who were there on one hand, okay? And, you know, I wish her the best of luck. But she and I had an opportunity to talk. And I talked about some of the old days, you know, because, back when I got involved with HRC, Elizabeth Birch was there, and some of the things, and I was telling her some of the things. These are the shoulders. They're not going to tell you about those of us who were in the room, but were not, and were probably supposed to be under the umbrella, and were made to feel often like, well, we couldn't be as proud of our black card as we were of our gay card. And if we were, how tough it was. And I said, mm-hmm. you're not going to hear those stories. Now we're all singing Kumbaya, and we've got Kelly, and she's black, and it's going to take us in a whole new way. But, you know, there are a whole lot of people who she, you know, and I just dropped a few names, and she was like, oh. And you can see her assistant was like basically, we're going to go back and look this up. Not having that history. And like I said, I wish her well, but you need to know the animal that you're with, because some things may not have changed. You know?
Hello.
Some things might just be under the cover because we want to look, have our kumbaya moment. But you need to know that history.
And yeah. I just want to say, and it's not that far away history. You know, this movement is new. And people always want to say, oh, well, that was so long ago. And I'm thinking, no, it really wasn't, because the people are still alive. They're still here. They're still doing work. So that's not that far away. It's not like we're all dead and gone. So,
hey,
you know, we're
real.
Go ahead. I'm sorry.
No, I mean, you and I are still kicking, you know, and I know a whole bunch of people who are still kicking, but who have, like you said, after a certain point, we didn't get the gains, and it wasn't like, and we did it because we were doing the work. You did it because you were doing the work. You don't have that corner office in New York or D.C., you know, with a driver and all like that. You were doing the work, and you're still doing the work, Kyla. I mean, you know, and we talked about, you know, like how many people go like, oh, the movement is just, we've got, you know, Pete Buttigieg, we've got all these other people who were appointed were first came to light under Obama, but Biden is just bringing these people in. his what's her name, Keir St. John. You know, she's there. We're just all there. But has the movement really come that far, particularly if you're trans and or black and gay?
Right. And disabled. Let's throw that on the table.
Thank you. Thank you.
Yeah. Let's throw that on the table. It really,
mm-hmm.
and I'm going to answer, even though I know you posed that as a theoretical question, but it hasn't, you know. And for those that are privileged, that get chosen and appointed for these positions, while some of us were looked over because we weren't in the right place or we didn't fit the right mold at the right time, it really hasn't. Because like you said, I'm not in the administration, but you pick somebody that fits what you're looking for, and then they don't have the history. So it's easy to talk bold and to be out there when you don't have the history or seem like you're the next best thing since sliced bread, which, and they can tell how old I am from that reference, or the coolest new kid on the block. I wish everybody well. I don't harbor hate, but what I dislike is the disingenuousness of, and I've always said this to funders, that we need to keep our history. Our history needs to be clear, and it needs to be inclusive history, not the history like is at the school where we don't include people and the fight that we are having now to whitewash our history because, you know, we're not including how we got here, the backs of the people that were used to get us here. And, I see that in every shift or change in the movement, you know, because it was only a few presidents ago that the only people that worked at the White House were interns. And then, I had somebody make fun of that was new to the movement, that, you know, gained power through a couple of presidents ago, and they really had never been in the movement, but they were somebody that somebody picked to come into the movement to work. And I said, that's not funny. I said, why are you laughing? I said, that's where we were in the movement. And that's why the history is so important for people to know, that, you know, they were just interns because that's all we could get, you know. And so that was important at the time that, you know, Julian Potter got into the White House and was first gay person that worked in the White House, or lesbian person, since she was lesbian, that worked in the White House. And Keith Boykins then was the next person. And they didn't have these big titles, but they played big roles, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And it's like none of us would be, nobody would be there had it not been for them. So that's important history for people to know, just as the history you're saying at HRC for Kelly is important to know. You know, I had somebody, and then somebody called me and said, oh, so-and-so is claiming to have been the first out trans person that worked at HRC, you know, and it's just like, you know, for their book or their benefit. And it's like, well, no, that seat was already taken by me, and I try to not make big deals out of that, but that they didn't know or didn't want to know. And I say first out person because there were a lot of people coming out, and I always seem to take the slack of those people, and that's another thing that people don't know, and particularly L or G people, or G people are the ones usually managing how the dynamics work between trans people coming out in an office space. So I'm out. I've been unabashedly out since I came out eons ago, and so people have issue with that. So then they want to pile their stuff on me and make complaints in the office of things that I didn't do to them. I remember there was one person at HRC that I was well protected at, and that didn't happen. But I confronted the person, and I said, hey, I don't even know you. I have no issues with you, and I'm not sure why you're having issues with me because I haven't done anything to you. And that person and I, and since that point, have been good friends. But it was because of their own issues of not being fully who they needed to be. And so I was the next best person to pick on because I was fully who I needed to be. And that happens all the time. And then the stuff that happens between trans men and trans women. And then the new non-binary people that think that non-binary people have never existed. You know, when non-binary people have always existed, and most of the trans guys my age live non-binary. And so that's why history is so important to talk about and to have. And that's why, you know, the creating change of old will definitely be missed, because we'll continue to have these misunderstandings and internal clashes when we need to be a strong, unified a group of people, because the fight we're going to have to fight now is horrendous. And while some of us have been through the fight when we had no rights whatsoever, a lot of us, these children have had lots of rights, and they can't withstand having no rights, you know, because when I came up, there was no organization to call, you know, knowing you were trans. There was nobody to back you back. Mm-hmm. And sadly, these children are then committing suicide because they don't know what else to do. And so, you know, we all need to be in this together. And then I'll add that, you know, and then honoring disabilities. You know, I've been disabled since I was in my late 20s. And I've been was at a meeting where somebody said, well, we need to get some disabled people on this board. And I can't wait till somebody wheels in. Well, one, I have to now use a wheelchair to get to meetings, and I will use a cane for the rest of it because I'm old school about doing things. And that person had no idea what they were saying, and then wanted to tell me I wasn't disabled. Well, you can't tell people. Thank you. You can't tell people if they're disabled or not. And most people haven't known I was disabled because I didn't disclose. But there are plenty of people that are disabled that you don't know about. And so you need to educate your people on disabilities. So, but yes, and that mine was paid out through workers' comp dollars, and I was 28 or 29. But I just never disclosed my disability because that's my right not to do that. But then I had further disabilities because literally I'm taking wheelchairs to get where I have to go right now. And I just kind of kept it quiet. But after that meeting, I just couldn't believe. And I finally left that board because there was so much racism on that board. Because as Michelle knows, I was the board chair of a board, led it through some difficult times. But I wasn't good enough to be a board chair on a white board. And that happens to people of color all the time. And I can't believe it happens in the LGBT community. It's bad enough it happens in regular community, although less and less, but that it even happens in the LGBT community. So we're not good enough to be the president or even the vice chair. They want us to be the people that do the accounting work or take notes. And it's like, oh, no. And then the people that became board chairs had no experience being board chairs anywhere and didn't have a clue how to run the meetings. And that's like, to me, and I have no patience for that, as Michelle knows. I know how to run a meeting and expect it to be chop, chop, chop on time and no Robert's Rules of Order forward and backwards. And then I got tired because it's like, you have no faith in any of my skills. What I said in the meetings were always questioned over other people. You think I can't see this? You know, I've been black since the day I was born, you know. And, you know, my parents lived through Jim Crow, and actually I lived through some of Jim Crow. So from where I was born and raised. So to think that people don't know what's going on, we're supposed to be changing the system. Let's change the system, and let's make it open for people with disabilities. Let's stop the ageism in the system too, by the way, because we have this whole ageism thing going on. Well, now they're old. Let's get them off the board. I've even had people say that. The best, have you heard that? Yeah, you need to go get off this and do whatever. It's like, did you hear that during the civil rights movement? I don't think I heard Dr. King say that. And honors to Dr. King, as it's his birthday that we'll be celebrating on Monday. I don't think that was said during the Civil Rights Movement, because they realized that to fight against other people, everybody was needed. Everything was plotted and planned. Rosa Parks didn't just end up on a bus by accident. Okay, that was planned. You know, all of these things were planned, and it's like, and it's not just about young people or old people. I go out and talk, and people will say, well, what about the young people? And it's like, well, I'm talking to everybody. Everybody needs to be doing these same things. So not just the other people, because I've actually been an advocate, not just for gay stuff, but I've been an advocate since I could walk and talk, because my parents were servant leaders. And so I was advocating as soon as I could at 8 years old, collecting for the March of Dimes, for doing this, doing that, and doing so forth. So there is no age limit. There is no young versus old. We got to all recognize and respect each other.
You know,
sorry, I didn't mean to preach a sermon.
No, but I think that's perfect, because you touched on a couple things, you know, about people with disability. I mean, a couple years ago, there was a young trans man here who had disabilities. I mean, after he got someplace, you might not have noticed, because no, he wasn't in a wheelchair, but he was disabled, and he couldn't attend or get to the things that he needed, and he eventually committed suicide. This past November, I went to, and you know, and whenever I go to things, there are things that I hear people planning. I ask them, you know, will you have someone who can sign? Is it handicap accessible so everybody can be there? And then I often tell people, I said, you know, are you putting something out as far as transportation? Because I went to a thing this year, and one of the speakers didn't come because they were disabled, and the bus that would bring them there that offered, like, that could help with their wheelchair stopped at a certain time, and they didn't know how they would get home. And I looked at one of the organizers and I said, you mean to tell me, of all of you good people, many who say that you are allies, not one of you said, I can go get them and make sure they get here and come back? So, and part of when it came up, I was saying, like, you know, I'm looking at your panel here and it doesn't seem diverse. Well, we invited so-and-so, but they couldn't get here because of it. I said, then you really aren't about diversity, equity, and inclusion if you don't think about all of these things. And if you wanted that person at your table, somebody who said you were an ally and, hey, we're all in this together, would have made sure that individual got here and got home safely.
Yeah.
And you see that all the time. And the same goes, and, you know, the other thing that I think of when you were talking about ageism, one of the most inspiring people who I had met, I met in my lifetime, who actually lived to be 100, was Grace Lee Boggs, and she believed in an intergenerational approach. And she would have people working with her who were everywhere from 20. When I met her, she was in her 80s. And she would wait in there because she believed everybody has something that you can bring to the table. Like she would talk about, she said, well, when it used to be when she needed to get out these pamphlets, that they had to use a machine and print them out and then do it. She said, well, now I can talk to one of these young people and say, we need to get this word out. And they knew all about the internet and how to do that. So we need all hands on deck. Ageism is BS, and I don't say people are disabled. I think that they're differently able, because with little or no help from society, they find a way to do it. You have found a way to get everywhere you need to be, you know, and you're not sitting there going like, oh, I can't because don't nobody can do it. If you need to be someplace, you find a way to do it. So these are, and we need all of these abilities. We need all these ages. And, you know, that's one of the things that I see as our organizations are good and bad. Because, like, Creating Change, part of why they went to virtual, and a lot of organizations went to that because of COVID, so that they could do virtual, and they have been able to reach a broader audience. But there's, like we've been talking about all along, with historical things that come in, how do you really make sure that everybody's at the table? What do you see moving forward? What would you like to see moving forward?
Well, you know, what I see moving forward, it's going to be tough, but as I always tell everybody, we do need to bond together. You just said one of the favorite things I'd love to hear. I think I said it with you a minute ago. We do need to bond together. We do need to, I do believe in intergenerational work. We've got to move to that point of intergenerational work and stop always saying, oh, the youth. It's like, you know, well, what about the elderly? And I hate that word, elderly. What about older adults? I prefer uh-huh. that much better because uh-huh. that's what people are. It's like elderly, I'm thinking, oh, they're, you know, that's some kind of negative thing to me. And we've got to realize that everybody's headed for a difficult time, whether they're LGBT or not. So we have to realize that and prepare for that. And I think organizations need to tool themselves to address some of the concerns that we've raised on this call and deal with them. All the isms, the racism, the sexism, we didn't hit that one really, but that's there. And if they don't, then what do we stand for? I mean, I think that's an ethical obligation. We say we stand for all of these things, but we really don't address them. And then I think individuals, you know, we've gone through this age of individuality in the movement that is just about me. When we started this movement and we got real vocal, which you've been around for, and actually I was around for as a person, it was about us. And I think we have to get to back to it's about us, but it's about us in an inclusive way. And then we've got to figure out how to be prepared to counter the extremism mm-hmm. on the religious right, and be pragmatic about that, because we're just people. And we've got to learn how to stop bringing a one-pony show. It's like, oh, we've got a new identity. How do we do with that? We need to realize that we're going to continue to have different identities roll into the movement, and we can't just stop and pause and focus on that identity and not take care of the people we got, because that's where we lose people, and that's where people feel like they don't belong and then commit suicide or don't feel a part of the movement. And I think if we get those things right, we can build a happy, healthy movement. An inclusive movement that is functional and that can be prepared to weather the storm that we're about to weather, you know, because these rights issues are, while it looks like they're targeting youth, the preparation is to target us all.
Mm-hmm.
So that we all have no rights. And you see that with how they progress, you know, because they've got this stuff in mind. And so that we can fight back on these bills and pieces of legislation. And while courts have been loaded with some of these right-wing judges, they're not all buying these cases and the story. So we should not be negative about that. So that's how and that's how I see it going, restructuring our movement to be inclusive. Not everybody's the same. Of course, within the movement, we have that split in our movement, the same as we have in this country. But I would like the movement to move to be more inclusive, so that we can have a better movement and fight towards the rights of everyone, and then take in people and be a more open movement. You know, in some ways, like it used to be. Mm-hmm. And I think you know what I'm saying, because it did used to be like you felt like you were safer in the movement than you were outside the movement. Now, to me, quite frankly, it feels safer outside the movement than within the movement.
Well, you know, now you and I, we both saw 2022. And even go back 2020, I think that we were able to like hold it together because there was such an orange circus going on that, you know, people were like, oh, you know, we just can't do this. 2022, it wasn't the red wave, wasn't the blue wave. Hey, Michigan came through. But Michigan came through blue.
It did.
But, I mean, the fact that Warnock and Herschel Walker went to a runoff, and it was even at, that sort of says a lot. And the fact that you still have these, you know, people who would, like Kevin McCarthy and people who still support Trump, you know, we hope for better. But I sort of see that, you know, 2024, we're going to have one heck of a fight together. What do you think? What do you think you see? What did you feel after the 2020, looking at 2018, look at 2022, looking forward towards 2024? What do you see? What do you, would you say if, you know, our LG, well, let's put it, our TLGB leaders or whatever political progressive allies or whatever came to you and said, Kyla, you've been in the game for a minute. What do we need to get our act together, or is this really going to be a fight? Well, how do we, you know, I just say, take off our earrings, Vaseline up our forehead. How do we get ready for this fight?
Well, I think we need to start educating ourselves to the issues and really read, and not just from social media. We need to read more than one source a day, and to keep up on all the issues. And again, I would like to see us stop, I don't want to use the word pose because people think of the show Pose, but I think we need to stop, you know, being out there showing our best wares and posing and all being movie stars, so to speak. And, you know, I think we need to get real and realize that we're going to have to fight for our lives. If anything, that I'll quote RuPaul, we're going to have to fight for our lives. And that's what's going to be in 2024, because this is mounting up to, we've had, and I'm going to be objective and just do, because I've done politics quite a bit. We've had an administration that's under the illusion that there's, that one person is still the president, which legally is not true, and that Biden is the president. And lots of people haven't liked Biden, but Biden has gotten more done than any other president under any marker, in the 2 years, and has had to deal with COVID and all of those things. Not that he hasn't made any gaffes, but everybody does. So I think people are going to have to say, what is good for the movement, and then make their decisions. But I think we all need to be on a campaign. We need to take off your earrings and high heels, if you wear them, and put on your walking shoes and sign up for one of the parties. And quite frankly, while it may be irritating, you know, because I've never really believed in our partisan party system. It's not that great. It doesn't work that great, but it's what we have. And I would say you need to be out on a Democratic Party, in the Democratic Party. And I know those of you that just aren't there. But the reality is the Republicans are not for us, and they've never been for us, you know. And so unless you're Caitlyn Jenner and have all that money, you're not safe, you know. You're just not safe. If you're not in the 1%, you're not safe. So because I've already seen them proposing tax increases for the poor, and it said that in the piece I read from them, and decreases them for the wealthy. Well, the wealthy already don't pay taxes, but we sure pay taxes out the nose. So I would suggest that you jump on a campaign, that you go do door knocking, that you go do whatever a campaign needs you to do. We need everybody on, all hands on deck, as Michelle said, and I always say that when I speak. We need all hands on deck in some way. Phone banking, doing door-to-door canvassing, working for candidates, particularly plugging into the Democratic machine. You can do it locally in your area. There are areas where you can also travel and do it. Some parts you can get paid to do. Others, volunteer time. You know, if you got 5 hours a week that you can do it in your area. But we're going to need to be on campaigns. And we're going to definitely need to be on lower ballots as well. Look, politics is local. But we're also going to need to fight for the presidency. You know, the Republicans have made it clear. Unfortunately, the Congress is not working for the people. And it used to be a day where Congress wasn't great, but they knew they were working for the people. Now Congress works for itself and does nothing for the people. And they showed that last week with the ridiculousness of what they did. Because we pay their paychecks, but they did what they wanted to do. So we need to hold them accountable in any way possible. And this whole ethical issue that I want to pose to everybody is look at your own ethics. And do you have ethics? And if you don't, you should have some ethics and think about what your ethics are. Take some time to listen to an ethical podcast, figure that out for yourself, and then figure out where your ethics align. We don't do that enough. And I used to require my students to do that because at some point, you know, you have to figure out where your ethics lie to lead you where you're going. And, you know, I have a strong ethical base, and there are things that I just won't do. And do I suffer for it? Yeah, I do, financially and otherwise. But it's worth it to me to be on the right side than to sell my soul. So that's what I would say to you is, yes, pull up your sleeves, take off your high heels, take off your earrings, and get busy for the next 2 years electing the right person for the president of the United States that follows the Constitution and doesn't rewrite the Constitution, because it's already been written. The people take an oath to follow it. And then do the same on the local level. But we've got to fight for a good president, and we need to really reelect everybody that is not following the Constitution and Congress as well. So that's what I would say the answer would be, to simplify it, Michelle.
Mm-hmm. Now, I know you are taking care of you. And, you know, I applaud you for that, because that's a lesson that many of us who have been in movement need to learn about taking a moment for self-care before it knocks you out of your butt. But you are taking that moment to take care of you. We have talked. I'm waiting for that book. But what, besides the book, what's next for?
Well, you know, I had to get knocked on my butt, and because I want to tell everybody self-care is very important. But I had to get basically a boulder and then a few storms thrown at me before I got knocked off my feet. And I finally got the message. So I have been advocating for everybody to do self-care on a regular basis, and I just was not wired that way, and almost lost my life. So I'm putting it back together, but I've still been advocating again against my doctor's orders because I just can't stop doing it. But I've learned to now go to bed and do those things because my body shuts me down. So what's next for me is doing a book, because I realize that, you've heard us talk already on this podcast that, you know, things haven't been captured or written down. And so I really thought, who cares about my life? But then as I watch things roll out, I think it's important, and I've had too many people ask me to do it. So what's next for me is writing a book. And then from there, I'm not sure, because I had been enamored with running for office, but I'm not in a, you know, I would need to relocate to do that, and I'm not sure where I would want to run for office at. So, you know, age is creeping up on me, but age doesn't mean anything. Where my heart is what it means something. So, it may be a run for office. It could possibly be that. but definitely I'm committing to writing this book. Hopefully I can get it out in the next year or so, and that's going to be the commitment I make at this point.
Mm-hmm. And will you be doing any speaking anywhere, or are you?
Oh, yes, I am speaking. I have two speaking agencies that I'm not quite up on the page of the other one, but I will be out there speaking. I've already started again doing that slowly, and as I get better with travel and it's not so painful, I will be doing lots more. But I plan on doing lots this year. I'm very excited to hit the speaking ground again. That's something that I do love, and I have many messages to share and hearts to lift up. So speaking is what I'll be doing mostly. So yes, I'll be speaking. You can find me online, just Google, and it'll come up, the agencies that I'm with, or you can book straight through me as well. So any of those things will work. But yes, thank you for asking that. So yeah, I'll be out speaking and doing that and having a good time. So
well,
and go ahead.
I mean you know, you're taking a minute, you're rebuilding. As the song goes, age ain't nothing but a number. You know, you've got,
that's right,
you've got a lot to say, a lot to give. You are a treasure. We have many national treasures that, you know, people need to hear about and do it. Hey, let me know. I'm there with you. Anything
else? Well, I'm going to come back to the podcast when I get the book together and let you know. And I've been honored, actually, by many of the people that have asked me to write a book, you know, that within the movement and outside the movement. I've been so shocked. It's like, you know, these writers that have written 20 or 15 books, and a lot of them have been cisgendered people saying, when are you going to write a book, you know? And that blew my mind away. So I'm looking forward to doing that. So I'd actually lost my memory for about a year so with Bell's palsy. So I'm glad to have that back and my sight back and my voice back. So I had quite a few obstacles there for a while. So.
Well, I know your voice is back. I mean, from last time I talked to you, your voice is back. You sound great. You really sound great. Yeah.
I'm thankful and I'm blessed, though. And I had to remember I had been a music major because my voice wasn't coming back the regular way. And then I started singing. And it's like, because I thought, oh, my God, without my voice, what will I do? You know, because it was such an intense, it's a unique thing. The way it sounds, and it's an integral part of me. And then I was crying in the shower, and then I remembered I was a music major in college, and it's like, hello. And it's amazing how you can pick new skills. And then I just started doing exercises, and bam, you know. So I'm thankful, grateful. So.
Well, we're going to talk again later this year. We're definitely going to talk about the book, but we're going to talk again on this podcast. We're going to see each, I'm putting it out there. We are going to see each other in 2023.
Yay.
And, I mean, that's just it. I'm just putting it out there. Kyler, what can I say? You know, you make me smile from the inside, and that keeps me going.
Well, you make me smile inside and outside, Michelle. So, I'm honored to hear that. So, and you definitely give me good energy, and I've loved working with you every single time we work together. So, thank you, sister.
Okay, well, I want you to go and enjoy the rest of your evening. I'm going to go and enjoy mine. I'm going to make myself a turkey burger.
Sounds good. Can you email me one? So.
I wish I could. So I might not cook much, but I can make a turkey burger.
Well, thank you very much for having me. You have a great evening.
Okay, Tyler, I'll talk to you real soon, okay?
All right. Take care. Bye-bye.
All right. Bye-bye.
I want to thank our guest, change agent, warrior, activist, and icon in the GLBTQ community, working for all of our rights, Kyler Brodus. Please like Collections by Michelle Brown on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter, so that you will always be kept apprised of our next guest. You can listen to the show on SoundCloud, Blog Talk Radio, iTunes, and Stitcher. Thank you for listening. Until next time, it's Collections by Michelle Brown, Blog Radio.
This episode of Collections by Michelle Brown is brought to you in partnership with the Center for Peace Counseling and Holistic Healing Services, bringing balance to your mind, body, and spirit. For more information or to schedule an appointment, visit the center at www.thecenterforpeacellc.com.